I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. With the political conventions mercifully over, headlines were all over the map this week. A number of them fell into a category that I'd call, I'll believe it when I see it. For instance, the imminent death of Kim Jong-il seems to have been greatly exaggerated. Or was it? And the world did not end in a black hole of our own making when scientists fired up the Large Hadron Collider over in Switzerland on Wednesday. Then again, they haven't done the really crazy stuff yet. And in Zimbabwe, which we followed pretty closely on this show, they say they finally got a deal that might actually make the government somewhat respectable for the time being. They'll announce it on Monday, and I'll believe it when I see it. Also in that category, the U.S. Congress went back to work this week after a nice summer break, presumably to get some actual stuff done. With all the problems we've got, especially in the economy, you'd think it would be a good time to buckle down. But can our elected representatives get anything done with an election hanging over us? Let's put the question to Professor Catherine Pearson, Congressional Specialist at the University of Minnesota. Catherine, welcome back to In the Loop.
Thank you.
So this is likely to be a pretty short session, maybe just through the end of the month. Is there anything that they have to get done?
Yes, they have to keep the government running. Every year by October 1st, Congress must pass and President Bush must sign 12 annual appropriations bills. Now, the one way they can get out of this is by passing what's called a continuing resolution to keep the federal government running in lieu of these appropriations bills as a short-term fix.
So what they're supposed to do is pass these appropriations bills that'll last us for the next year. Does anybody actually want to do that?
Well, I think at this point, you know, each party has an incentive to punt the continuing resolution until January because they view it as, you know, possible that their party could be president.
All summer, while Congress was out of session, Republicans continued to walk onto the darkened House floor and call for more drilling, more oil drilling, which I think we can all admit was pretty much just a publicity stunt. But now they're back. And so, what, the real work starts on energy policy, right?
Right, right. And what has happened over this congressional recess has really been a change in congressional Democrat strategy. It's not that the Republicans on a dark House floor were so successful, but it is that public opinion is in favor of expanded drilling off the coast, and more specifically, Democrats who are worried about their reelection in November are really pressing their Democratic leadership to allow for some offshore drilling.
Do you expect we might get a substantial, workable, big new energy bill out of the next few weeks?
I do. It looks as of now that House Democratic leaders will bring up an energy bill next week. And this bill will give states the option of offshore drilling between 50 to 100 miles offshore and then allow offshore drilling beyond 100 miles. Now, you know, of course, things can change between now and then, but that's what the current negotiations are producing among Democrats.
So the Democrats have adapted on some of the energy stuff, but there's still no guarantee this will be something President Bush will actually sign.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think that will depend on how the president and congressional Republicans see this affecting Republicans' electoral outcomes.
Democrats control both the House and Senate, so naturally they seem to have the most ideas heading into this session. They also were talking about a second economic stimulus package of about $50 billion, which could include all kinds of things, infrastructure repairs, home heating subsidies, you name it. Could that turn into anything significant for the American people?
Well, I would not be surprised at all if there were votes on this stimulus package in the House and in the Senate. After all, Democrats control the agenda. They control what gets to the floor. But I would be surprised if the president would be willing to sign a bill that lets congressional Democrats declare victory.
So we've been talking about the very few highly significant things that might happen during this session. But there's going to be probably a lot of other stuff passed, right? What's the other typical sort of like day-to-day business that happens during this kind of a congressional session?
Well, you'd be amazed at how many sort of small and symbolic measures pass routinely in the House and the Senate. Everything from naming post offices to honoring constituents to very small sort of legislative provisions that would never make the front page of the news, but nonetheless give members of Congress the ability to go home and campaign and say, I got something done.
Stuff we can all agree on, even in these acrimonious political times.
Exactly.
Catherine, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Catherine Pearson is a professor of political science at the University of Minnesota. One more thing Catherine says Congress might feel harmonious enough to deal with this month: fixing the alternative minimum tax. I'll believe it when I see it. You are listening to The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. You can find In the Loop on Facebook or podcast the show at minnesotapublicradio.org. We can't consider The Week without mentioning Ike, which I like to think of as the only hurricane named for a bit character on South Park. Though at this moment, the big news is really yet to come. It's amazing to see the map with Ike basically taking up the entire Gulf of Mexico. Seems likely to hit near Houston early Saturday morning. And if you're wondering if this will be a really big deal, the National Weather Service does not want you to be confused. I see text from the National Weather Service flash across my computer all day long, and it is the most boring stuff you'll ever read. But for Ike, they're putting aside the usual bureaucratic modesty. Here's some of the National Weather Service warning.
All neighborhoods and possibly entire coastal communities will be inundated during the period of peak storm tide. Persons not heeding evacuation orders in single-family one- or two-story homes will face certain death.
Well, we added some emphasis, of course, but that is the actual National Weather Service language, will face certain death, a phrase they actually haven't used since Katrina. It does make it sound a little bit like the National Weather Service will be coming around and executing you if they do find you in your house, but it certainly does get the message across. Get the heck away from the Texas coastline. And people are doing that in droves today. Aside from Ike, the other name whipping like a hurricane through the news this week was, of course, Sarah Palin. There is a huge fascination with John McCain's running mate. Now, in her first solo interview last night, she clearly didn't know what the Bush Doctrine was. But that's a hard question. You know, I'll bet even Bush, if you sat him down, would have been like, "I'm sorry, the Bush what?" Sarah Palin this week had the covers of Time, Newsweek, People, Us Weekly. We didn't see Joe Biden on the cover of Us Weekly. Lots of curiosity about her background, her personal style, her family. She's turning out to be nothing if not highly marketable. Which is why I guess it should have been no surprise to run across this infomercial on late night TV. It's a dilemma so many of us face at some point in our lives.
So I've got this kid. Now, what am I supposed to call it?
Most common baby names feel so ordinary. But you want your kids to stand out, turn heads. Now, from a reformer with fresh ideas, an outsider used to shaking up the establishment, comes the Sarah Palin Baby Naming System. As the mother of Bristol Willow Piper Track and Trig, the Alaska governor knows a thing or five about naming babies. The Sarah Palin system relies on a deceptively simple two-step process. Step one.
Find something you like.
It could be a charming vista, like Bristol Bay. Or the Piper aircraft you fly on hunting trips. Or the sport of track and field. Seriously, that's all you need. Then, on to step two.
Name your baby that.
It's that easy. Just pick something you like, and that can be your kid's name. Go ahead, try it out.
I'd like to Needlepoint.
Why not? Needlepoint Johnson. I love it.
I like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Buccaneer? That's a great name.
I love Grey's Anatomy, but I'm not sure how that would sound with Dollar Schmidt.
Don't worry. With reformer Sarah Palin blazing the way, there's nothing off limits. The Sarah Palin Baby Naming System can be yours for only $29.95, including more details on both steps, a motivational CD, and if you order in the next 20 minutes, this limited edition lapel pin featuring a pit bull with lipstick. Don't delay. Supplies are limited. And remember, living in America means freedom, including the freedom to name your kid anything you want. Hey there, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Today, we got retailing sales figures for the last month, and they turned out quite a bit worse than many people were expecting. These are tough days for stores. Consumer confidence is lousy. But throughout the economic slowdown, the American economy's saving grace has been productivity. And struggling retailers are hoping they can eke out even more of it from their workers with sophisticated and, frankly, kind of scary-sounding new software. Vanessa O'Connell caught my eye this week with a great story about this in the Wall Street Journal, and she's on the phone with me now to break it down. Vanessa, thanks for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
I imagine as long as businesses have had employees, they've been monkeying with people's schedules to try and make things run better. So what's new, would you say, with the software that you wrote about in this case?
It's very true. The schedule is critically important in retail. Often, the store managers have to sort of do it by spreadsheet on paper with a pen. What's new with this is it essentially automates all of that. The retailers can now sort of follow the performance metrics of the employee. In other words, you know, how much they're selling, dollars per hour that they sell in merchandise. These scheduling programs can tap into that, figure out who the most productive employees are, and rank them. And then schedule the store hours, giving the most productive employees the greatest number of hours and the least productive the least number of hours.
And placing them during the day, I suppose, in hours when they're going to have the most effect.
Right. So the systems will automatically figure out how busy the day will be and when the peak times will be. Then the software will schedule the most productive employees for the busiest times.
Do employees know from week to week what their hours are going to be?
No, it's a real headache for employees because each week their schedule can have huge variance in the number of hours they could work. So one week they might be working 20 or 25 or even 35, and the next week they might be working 8.
You talked to a number of people at Ann Taylor, the retailer of women's clothing. What's the effect on workers who need to learn how to exist under this system?
The workers had a lot to say about how the system influenced the culture of the workplace, including the fact that it got a lot more competitive. Because once they became aware that there was a scheduling system that was giving the most productive workers the most hours per week, the workers became a lot more competitive with one another so that they could have the higher ranking.
At Ann Taylor, the system they use is called Atlas, I think, if I recall correctly, which is an acronym for something. It doesn't really matter. One of the things that I really loved about the article is that Ann Taylor told you they decided the system needed a name because then workers would hate the system instead of hating the company. How is that working for Ann Taylor?
All I had to do is ask people, what do you think of Atlas? And they would go on and on and on and on. And it worked maybe short term, but long term, people start to...
You put two and two together.
Yeah. You know, the company put this in place for a reason.
Now, one company that makes the software that Ann Taylor and other businesses use also said to you that they know that this can be taken too far by some of their clients. What do you think would be taking it too far? What are they talking about there?
Well, generally, with these sorts of programs, the shorter your shift, the more efficient the schedule is because they won't even give you an extra 15 minutes in your schedule if it looks like that's a time when customer traffic is starting to fade off. Retailers could start using this to really shorten the shifts that workers are given, and that creates some hardship, especially if you're traveling from a distance to get into the store. Another way is to push it too far by not taking into account employee preferences in any way. If I were a top-ranked employee, I may not necessarily want to work all day Saturday when there's lots of people in the store, or work evenings because that's when the people who are getting home from work tend to shop. If you're treating your employees this way, are they happy employees and do they serve the customer well when the customer comes in the store?
Presumably, bosses in all kinds of fields would be curious about a tool like this. I'm kind of wondering where it goes after retail. I mean, could they apply this to journalists, you know, tracking your keystrokes and the number of stories you put out? What's your most productive time of day? Can you imagine that?
Absolutely. I don't think that's really too far away. Already, this technology is spreading pretty quickly into healthcare, food service, and into the hotel business, for example. I really don't think it's too far away that we will see similar kinds of programs for all kinds of professions.
Vanessa, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
That's Vanessa O'Connell from The Wall Street Journal. You know, at one point earlier this week, I think it was Tuesday, my producer, Sandin, and I were looking around at the news, and it just felt like there was a ridiculous number of headlines about Google. Sandin did a quick count, and it turned out there were no less than 10 completely distinct stories in the mainstream media at that one moment about Google. It seems like Google is always in the news, but this week was especially chock full. So Brian Ussery is with me to talk through just a few of these items. Brian writes for the Google Blogoscoped blog, and he works for a search engine marketing agency in Atlanta. Brian, thanks for helping us with the week in Google.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Hard to know where to start with all this stuff, but this one seems interesting. Google sets out to bring the internet to poor countries. What's going on there?
They have partnered up with some other companies in using satellites to bring high-speed internet access to poor countries. Once you get the high-speed internet access into a certain region, then you have to be able to divvy it up, and that can be done, you know, by a phone line, by cable, or by Wi-Fi. And another interesting initiative, I guess, that few people are aware of is that Google's actually looked into different ways of suspending Wi-Fi receivers and transmitters from balloons.
Okay, let me just stop you. So Google is talking about suspending Wi-Fi access from weather balloons over third world nations.
Yes, that is one potential scenario.
So the reason there's not great internet access in poor countries is that presumably nobody really can make a buck at it. Why would Google want to do it?
They could monetize it by being able to provide the little ads that go on the side, which is actually how they make their money in the first place. So by opening it up to, say, everyone, you know, in Africa, there's a lot of money to be made for Google.
So Google might be able to make some money by doing this, but all the same, it's kind of a warm and fuzzy Google headline. Here's another one, though, from this week. Google's looking at a possible antitrust lawsuit from the U.S. Justice Department. Over what?
Google has an arrangement with Yahoo to place Yahoo's paid search results in with their own search results. The question is whether or not that is reducing competition.
So maybe illegal consolidation
Yes.
in the search engine
Yes.
and presumably, you know, search advertising industry.
Exactly. So in other words, they're saying that by owning that number of ads, Google could control the price of all ads that are seen by Yahoo and by Google, and that's where the question is. The important thing, I think, to remember here is that they're trying to generate cash, yes, but also to generate help Yahoo generate cash, which could possibly keep Yahoo in business. And I think most people would consider that as keeping competition alive rather than reducing competition.
Here's another headline for you. Google is cutting back the time that it holds our personal data. First, what do they have?
It's so broad that it could be anything from snippets in Gmail to what pages, what sites you've been to. No one really knows what they're using the information for except for Google. It could be used to profile users to serve better ads, and that's Google's main interest.
So they had been holding it for 18 months?
18 months, yes.
Well, why do they no longer need it for 18 months?
I think a number of privacy advocates have been opposed to Google retaining too much data, and the European Union, I also believe, has put pressure on them in some ways. But at the same time, privacy is so important at Google, they recently added a link to their privacy policy from the bottom of the homepage.
And as Google followers know, they add almost nothing to that pristine homepage. That's a pretty big deal.
It is, absolutely. At one point, there were 24 words on the homepage, and that's actually to make sure the page loads as fast as it possibly can on any platform that can be used to access it.
All right, Brian Ussery helping us out with the week in Google. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian is the director of search engine optimization for the company Search Discovery, and he joined us from Atlanta. You can see more of his Google tracking at blogoscoped.com. Here's some of those other Google headlines from this week. Google's getting into the business of selling TV commercials. Google plans to digitize millions of newspapers. Google helps tank United Airlines stock. And Google calls on the U.S. to be off fossil fuels by 2030. You're listening to The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. One particular phrase got a very good workout in the public consciousness this week: too big to fail. You'll recall the week started with the federal government taking over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage giants. Another investment bank, Lehman Brothers, is scrambling for whatever kind of bailout or buyout it can get, citing the precedent set by Bear Stearns. And the U.S. automakers are in Washington, making essentially the same argument. We can't go down. We're too essential to the economy. Too big to fail. Too big to fail. Too big to fail. The more I repeated this phrase of the week, the more it sounded like, it ought to be a John Prine song or something. And so, here you go. I come to you now with my hat in my hand, and I chose you because I know you'll understand. We got here, I know, through my very own blunder. but I'm far too important to let me go under. Fannie and Freddie bought lots of bad loans, dug deeper and deeper, did it all on their own. Shareholders probably all thought they'd get rich, but that last mortgage bill was a son of a gun. And Bear Stearns set the standard for how you get stuck. I keep trading, keep laughing, neck deep in the muck. Ain't it ironic as they flail and shout, got so fat we got no choice but help pull them out. I know that we all should accept our mistakes, but imagine me folding, just think of the stakes. I know it might feel like unbeaching a whale, too screwed up to ignore and too big to fail. The big three in Detroit know that they missed the boat. A couple more quarters might be all she wrote, but they figure they're such a national treasure, the cost of their failure too tragic to measure. Up on Capitol Hill, hear their pleas and the moans for a cool $50 billion in low interest loans. In the end, Congress must make the decision. How big a reward for complete lack of vision? Well, the big problem is all the jobs they supply. A whole lot of folks make those cars we won't buy. And though in the end we're just chasing our tail, they're too screwed up to ignore and too big to fail. And once you get started, where do you draw the line? Lots of folks on the ropes, whose collapse don't we mind? The more bailing you need, the bigger the pail. If only we all could be too big to fail. The Week is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Special thanks to Jackie Fuller, Annie Baxter, and Michael Caputo for lending their voices to the Sarah Palin baby naming system infomercial. Our theme and our jazzy bed music, like this stuff, is by The Smarts. Learn more about them and more about us at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. We're presently on the hunt for new people to join us as correspondents for our week in whatever segments that we do. If you track a niche area of news and you'd like to come in and give us a briefing, let us know who you are. We also want your pithy poems on the week's news. Been a little while since we had one of those. And we're cooking up some new ways for you all to get involved in the show. There are two great options for you to keep track of what we're up to. One, sign up as a fan on our awesome In the Loop page in Facebook. And two, join the Loop Network, and we'll email you every now and then with ways that you can help us build and grow the show. One of those ways of growing the show, of course, is we love it when you share it with your friends and family all over the country. Thank you for listening. I'm Jeff Horwich. Have a great weekend and a great week to come.